Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio today, Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at East Carolina University, joining us by phone, noted shark expert and director of the International Shark Attack File, from Florida University, George Burgess. It's Shark Sense today, and if you'd like to ask our shark experts a question, now's your chance. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. We have an email from Mike Rann who says, are there specific steps that can be taken to prevent being bitten? I've heard of chemical and natural shark repellents, as well as wetsuits and surfboards painted with stripes that sharks will stay away from. Is there any trustworthy data to support these or other similar claims? George Burgess.
This has been an area of research ever since World War II. Of course, during World War II, lots of naval aviators and sailors went into the sea during the war, and the Navy particularly wanted to get an anti-shark measure. And in fact, the International Shark Attack File, which we curate, owes its existence to naval funding in the late 1950s that got started. Over the years, scientists have found a variety of things that sharks don't like, lots of chemicals that they don't like. In fact, the best thing to chase a shark away is just take a bottle of Ivory liquid soap and squirt it in their face, and they'll go running. But the problem is the sea is a big diluter, and so you would have to have literally barges full of these chemicals going in the water all the time to keep sharks away from somebody. So that's the big problem there. We've also found that electrical fields and magnetic fields can be uncomfortable for sharks, and so there's been work over the years to develop things in those areas as well. Those works continue, and there's some companies out there that have provided a personal shark protection device that produces an electric current around the person. But clearly this is not something that everybody would want to wear, and frankly, doesn't need to wear. Those would be valuable, perhaps, for professionals who spend every working hour in the sea and want this extra protection, but not for your average bather. So some of these other things continue to go, and I got to tell you the truth. When we have shark attacks like this, my phones ring off the hook and my emails burn with people with ideas that they want to market, and there's no shortage of ideas.
Have you heard of any good ones recently, considering this spate of attacks?
One of my favorite ones from this time around was a woman who was concerned that, this is kind of an attractant story, but it tells you the nature of the interest. A woman was worried about giving her children fish oil pills, because she thought that that they would be attracting the sharks if she gave those to her children. So we get stuff on the other side where people offer us solutions that are a bit off the wall.
Is that so, just to indulge us for a moment, is that so unreasonable? You ingest fish oil pills, it comes out through your pores in one way or another. It would be so diluted by the ocean that it wouldn't be traceable by a shark's nose?
Right. I think that's the take-home message. It's the same thing as for finding something that doesn't work. Finding something that does work probably has got a dilution factor, too. And even if you have that essence to do a cod liver oil on your breath or in your sweat or something, it's not likely to do much. And in fact, we get calls from women who want to know whether they should go in the water when they're menstruating. Well, liquids of any kind are attracted. Human liquids are of any kind are of interest to sharks. But again, you'd have to have every woman synchronous at the same time going out along a beach to probably attract sharks.
So you're saying in the case of a woman who's having her period, her alone, that would be unlikely to draw a shark to her. She would not be at any greater risk than, say, the man 50 yards down the beach. Is that what you're saying?
No, not probably not, just because of the dilution factor, of course. But, if you have a you know, a whole army of women that are having their periods synchronously, well, then maybe you would have a problem.
Chuck Bangley, how are shark populations doing in general? Are they a protected species? Which ones are more threatened at this point?
It really depends on what kind of shark you're talking about. And North Carolina is a real hot spot for sharks. So we have sharks that can still be regularly encountered here that have really severely declined, and they're pretty rare in other states. But because North Carolina is kind of a sweet spot between major ocean currents, those species are still here.
And what are some examples of those species?
So we have the dusky shark here in North Carolina. It's a very it's a really cool looking, just classic looking shark. It's a big gray shark. They typically occur a little bit farther offshore, although their pups will swim up close to the beach, particularly in the winter. And they're very slow growing. They don't reach reproductive maturity until about 17 years old. So a dusky shark has to live for 17 years before it can basically replace itself. And because of that, they've been very severely overfished. Although there is some signs of life in that population. A recent assessment that was done actually to determine whether or not dusky sharks would be listed on the Endangered Species Act actually found that there had been an increase recently in the numbers of juveniles found, and there were even some positive signs in the adult population. So sharks here in North Carolina, their populations are not nearly as high as they were historically, but some of them are starting to bounce back from declines a little bit.
Do we see great whites around here? Most of us know about Mary Lee. This is a great white shark that has been tagged by OSearch.
Yes.
And so we know that she travels through here from time to time. But is it typical to see a great white shark off the coast of North Carolina?
We've actually they're kind of irregular visitors to the coast. We used to maintain an acoustic array with the help of North Carolina Sea Grant off of Cape Hatteras. And it turns out that Cape Hatteras is a major kind of bend in the road for everything migrating up and down the coast. So in addition to the dogfish and sandbar sharks that we would tag, we would pick up white sharks that were tagged originally in Cape Cod. And we'd usually get about a handful of them every winter. We'd get them in the kind of early winter, late fall, and then we'd see them again in the kind of late spring as they were heading back north. Some of the satellite tag white sharks have done some pretty interesting behavior off of North Carolina. There have been a few that, there's a margin of error on these tags, but there have been a few that have looked like they've actually entered Pamlico Sound. And then I believe Catherine, another OSearch tag shark, was cruising off the coast of Hatteras this past weekend, which is pretty unusual. They typically are off of North Carolina in the winter rather than the summer.
We have a tweet from Sarah Finn, and she says, it's interesting because she's raising an issue that we've heard about before. There's been internal debate at least one other news organization in this market regarding the use of the term attack versus bite. And we've also talked about it here and just determined for various reasons, and we'll get into this discussion, but attack has been a reasonable term to us. Unreasonable to other people. George Burgess, you are using that term in your international shark attack file at the University of North Carolina. But Sarah says it misrepresents interaction, and it feeds unnecessary fear, works against conservation. How would you respond to that, George Burgess?
Two words. I'd say bah humbug. The reality is there are dog bites and there are dog attacks. There's shark bites and there's shark attacks. It's dependent on the degree of the situation. In Florida here, we have lots of shark bites in a given year. We have over 25 interactions between sharks and humans. Of those, 95% of them are bites. They're quick grabs and let goes by small sharks, resulting in little injuries. They don't deserve the word attack associated with them because they're just bites, the equivalent of a dog bite. Now, we also have a small number of attacks that occur here, which are done by larger sharks that result in larger injuries. What we've seen in North Carolina primarily have been attacks this year. They haven't been bites. They've been bites. They've been grabs by larger sharks that have done major damage. A couple of them, unfortunately, the teenagers lost their arms. There's no way in the world those are bites. They're attacks, just like you might have a chihuahua gives you a dog bite, but a pit bull in the backyard might tear your arm off. That's an attack.
Chuck Bangley, ECU shark researcher, do you have a different feeling about that, or do you share George Burgess's view?
Generally, I kind of agree with George. I use the term bites because I consider it to be a little more inclusive. We have had a few of the incidents here in North Carolina that do seem to be those kind of blacktip or spinner shark bites where they're going after a fish and they either mistake somebody's foot for it or they miss the fish and hit the foot that was behind it. And those are typically, I mean, they're not fun to go through, but those wounds are very rarely life-threatening, and the shark usually just lets go almost immediately. So I use bites to kind of include both those and the kind of more serious kind of predatory attacks. I just, you know, I find bites to be, you know, it's one syllable. But I find it to be more of a catch-all term. And, you know, I kind of agree with the person sending the tweet as well that, you know, you want to use attack if it's appropriate. You don't want to call a nip from a blacktip shark an attack necessarily, because that's not even a species that targets particularly large prey. It's not going to be trying to eat a person.
Mm-hmm. Case of mistaken identity in that case.
Yes, and even with some of the larger sharks, a lot of the time it's a bite and release kind of situation. Unfortunately, with some of the larger sharks, they're big and strong enough that even a test bite or an accidental hit can do a lot of damage.
We hear the statistics. It's so unlikely that someone will actually die from an attack by a shark. And George Burgess, you wrote recently in an opinion piece for CNN, having so many shark attacks take place so close in time and locale is extremely rare. But you said, still, you're more likely to die of a bicycle accident than an encounter with a shark. And yet, two young people lost parts of their arms, as you said, on Oak Island. Those are horrifying stories. Is the fear of serious and permanent injury irrational? Is that actual risk elevated right now, George Burgess?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at these things at two levels. You can look at them at the personal level. The individuals who got bit, it doesn't matter whether we called it a bite or an attack. You know, the injury they've got is severe, and they've got some big hurdles to jump over here for the rest of their life. And so our hearts go out to these people, you know, regardless of what you want to call it. So there's no irrationality involved with worrying about suffering a major injury. That's just being prepared and being vigilant. So we shouldn't be worried about that. What we do need to do, though, is also look at the big picture. And the big picture is last year in the entire world, there were only 3 fatalities associated with shark attack. So considering hundreds of millions of hours are spent in the sea worldwide, to only have 3 people walk in the water and not come back because of a shark pretty much puts it in perspective. Now, it doesn't make you feel any better if you're one of those 3, but the reality is that your odds of being attacked, far less dying, are almost infinitesimal. On the other hand, you can have situations like we've seen in North Carolina where you get the perfect storm of factors that are coming together that result in a situation where over that area in a shorter period of time, your odds are higher than usual. And that's what we've seen in North Carolina. The conditions are right. And so your chances of putting your foot in the water in North Carolina and getting bitten right now are higher than they were at this time a year ago, and probably higher than they will be next year at this time, because we won't necessarily have all this thing lining up the way it has. So in the end, this comes down to the fundamental point, which is when you enter the sea, you're entering a wilderness. It's a wilderness experience, and we're ecotourists every time we enter the sea. And as such, we need to remember that there's a certain amount of risk that we assume when we engage in a wilderness experience. And obviously for us, the greatest danger about aquatic recreation isn't sharks. It isn't drowning, which it takes thousands of people a year. It's riding the car to and from the beach. That's where we need to be most careful, because far more people are injured or killed in the cars going to or from the beach than drowning and shark attacks combined.
And once again, George Burgess, when was the last time a person died from a shark attack in North Carolina?
You know, I don't have that answer for you at the top of my head. Maybe our other guest has that, but it's been decades.
Yeah, I believe it was 2001 was the last actually fatal shark incident in North Carolina.
That's right. That was off the Outer Banks. That's right.
It was in the Hatteras area.
And there were two people that suffered serious injury in that incident, and one woman wound up in the hospital, and her partner, I think, was...
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Yep.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about sharks. What's really out there to fear? How can you minimize your chances of a shark encounter? And what do we need to understand about these mysterious creatures? We have two well-respected shark experts to answer your questions today. George Burgess is the director of the Florida Program for Shark Research and the International Shark Attack File, both housed at the University of Florida's Museum of Natural History. And Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at East Carolina University, is with us in the studio. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. Chuck Bangley, why do we care, taking a look at this from a conservationist point of view, why do we care about protecting sharks?
So sharks are, as top predators, they actually occupy a pretty important cog in the food web. Some of the research I'm doing is actually looking at how often they occur in certain habitat types. The eventual goal with that is to see whether or not habitats that are regularly patrolled by sharks through kind of trickle-down effects through the food chain end up actually being better habitats for juvenile fishes like red drum or flounder or spotted sea trout. And the reason for this is that sharks will actually scare off the predators of these juvenile fish. So most of these fish are too small for a large coastal shark to really pay attention to. But they will eat things like bluefish and bottlenose dolphins that are in there trying to feed on the juvenile fish. So an area that's regularly patrolled by sharks may actually be a healthier fish nursery. And that can actually lead to increased numbers of these fish species that end up on our own plates.
We have a follow-up tweet from Seraphin. She says, thanks for addressing on the air. I would argue it does matter what we call the interaction. It has a direct effect on public opinion and fear. And she says, I've been bah humbugged by George Burgess. If you'd like to ask a question of our shark experts, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138, send an email to coastline@whqr.org, or tweet us at coastlinehqr. And we've seen, of course, this is Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, which probably has something to do with getting more mileage out of the recent shark incident headlines. Is it true that sharks can be playful? And I'm thinking about great white sharks and a documentary footage showing a person who tries to engage with them from a boat and then will jump in the water and actually develop some kind of rapport. And Chuck Bangley is looking at me with furrowed brows going, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Does that sound at all plausible to either of you?
It doesn't seem like a great idea. I mean, these are fairly intelligent animals. There have been some people who have – they have a brain-to-body size ratio that's more similar to mammals than it is to other fish. And some people have speculated that they may be as intelligent as house cats or dogs. I've actually done a captive feeding study with spiny dogfish sharks, which are a smaller species, but they're very social. They occur in large schools. And over the course of keeping them captive in this tank, they kind of got used to me. And it reached a point where they would kind of expect the food from me. They'd look out of the water at me and stuff. But I would not recommend trying to kind of befriend a larger shark. And even with the spiny dogfish, I mean, that wasn't a relationship that I sought out. And I'm not sure it was actually there. I think they just got more comfortable with me.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We have two shark experts today answering your questions. If you'd like to ask George Burgess of the International Shark Attack File a question or Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at ECU, a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Coastline.